Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the program, the first transfer of 40 Yellowstone National Park bison to 16 tribes across the nation occurred. Why has this been so hard?
Because of this disease, we needed to find a way to first certify them as brucellosis-free.
I'll speak with the director of Wyoming's Department of Workforce Services, who says all is not lost.
I think that it's not doom and gloom. We're hearing about some real opportunities across the state.
We will also look at Wyoming's enhanced efforts towards carbon capture. And there's no cowboy football this fall or the Western Thunder Marching Band.
Without the bands on game days, it would be awfully quiet.
It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming leadership is doubling down on carbon capture as a tool to help preserve coal. That effort is building urgency as the pandemic devastates the struggling industry. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports that some think it's too late.
Earlier this year, organizations got together across Wyoming to give testimony about the largest utility in the state's controversial plan to make a shift away from coal and towards renewables.
Welcome, everyone, to this hearing of the Wyoming Public.
The plan didn't sit well with many, including Kent Connolly. The Lincoln County Commissioner said when PacifiCorp's plant in his county shuts down early, it's not just jobs leaving.
I lose 50% of the taxes. It's just that simple.
Connolly says it doesn't have to be like this. Coal plants in Wyoming could stick around if utilities just considered retrofitting them with something called carbon capture.
We will change how we use coal in America. There's no doubt about it. We'll get there with carbon recapture.
The idea is that a regular coal plant would be retrofitted with the technology and remove its emissions, and then some entity could use those emissions for some other profitable purpose. Capturing carbon could help address climate change. Even the United Nations has called for more of it to reduce emissions. But PacifiCorp says, right now, it's too expensive and unproven. Utilities Rick Link says its decision is an economic one.
The entire analysis is driven by shifts and changes in the market conditions.
Carbon capture is not a new idea in Wyoming. The state has supported it for over a decade, just about since production started trending downward for coal. But recently, support for it has started to ratchet up. This year, Wyoming's legislature passed a bill mandating utilities produce a certain amount of electricity from coal plants using carbon capture by 2030. It would be up to ratepayers to reimburse the utility for the extra expense. The state also recently acquired responsibility from the feds to permit wells to store carbon dioxide underground. And state leadership has held several public hearings recently to promote the tech, including the governor's office, who offered alternatives to PacifiCorp's plan, focusing instead on carbon capture.
That in Wyoming, burning coal is not the issue. It is the release of CO2 that we should focus on. This delegation is part of our strategy to use today's technology, such as carbon capture, utilization, and storage, to keep coal burning, reduce CO2 emissions, and keep jobs here in Wyoming.
The Trump administration has also provided significant funding for several new phases of carbon capture projects through the University of Wyoming. Dr. Holly Krutka directs the school handling those efforts. She was recently on a panel alongside other Wyoming leadership at the Integrated Test Center in Gillette, a state-backed carbon capture test facility. She envisions capturing CO2 emissions for a variety of profitable reasons, including turning them into new products.
Products like soil amendments, building materials, asphalt replacement.
Or they could be used to pull more oil from the ground or be turned into a low emission gas. All this urgency comes as coal production has fallen to historically low levels. Since last June, consumption of it has dropped by a fifth. And just since March, Wyoming has seen over 600 coal-related layoffs. The hope for some is that carbon capture could help rebuild that demand for coal. The problem is, others think the moment for carbon capture, at least to help the resource, has passed. Arizona State University's Klaus Lochner remembers giving presentations promoting it to the coal industry in the early 2000s, warning that climate change would be the resource's demise.
I said, look, if the year 2020 comes around, you are not going to be allowed to build a new coal plant because every bank in the country will know that they will not get their money back. So you better, by 2020, have the ability to build power plants that are completely carbon neutral.
But it never took off. Since then, only one coal plant in the U.S. ever successfully used carbon capture, called Petra Nova in Texas. But the pandemic forced it to shut down, with the oil price crash making it uneconomic. Energy economist Rob Godby says things could have gone differently had the Republican Party been more on board early on.
If the party that usually supports coal hadn't kind of gone down this dead-end road of climate change doesn't exist, because that undermined coal's interests by, you know, if climate change doesn't exist, there's no justification to develop low-carbon technologies like carbon capture.
Analyst Dennis Wamsted with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, a renewable think tank, says now he can no longer imagine a utility saying,
hey, we really want to do this. We really want to build a carbon capture facility, and we really want to put it on our 35-year-old, 40-year-old coal plant, and we're going to prove it's going to make money.
But leadership in Wyoming isn't just going to give up. Governor Mark Gordon pointed to the wind industry in its early days.
At the time, there was a lot of conversation about how wind generation had no economic future. It was a waste of time, et cetera, et cetera. So fast forward to the last several years, and you see as these pinwheels start showing up in the West, how much more economically viable they are.
Godby agrees. If carbon capture will succeed, it'll need incentives and opportunities to show itself off to those utilities. And that's what Governor Gordon and other leaders are working to do. As he adds, quote, we know the urgency. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
As many of you know, it was a rough spring for Wyoming's workforce. Unemployment skyrocketed with the closure of many businesses due to COVID-19. The federal government provided assistance, but it took a while to get the roughly $336 million it paid out into people's hands. Robin Cooley is the director of the Wyoming Department of Workforce Services. She says when the pandemic hit Wyoming, things changed overnight.
I think that my job and my life changed just like just about everybody in this agency. It was all of a sudden overnight, implementing new programs, recognizing the need out there in the communities and across the state, and just really trying to ramp up all of these, all of this information coming at us. Not only ramping the programs up, but trying to get the information out to individuals in a timely and easy to understand manner. So it was quick, fast, and all hands on deck. And I just have to give kudos to every person in this agency.
You know, obviously dealing with the federal government and how slow some of the money was initially, just I'm sure there were plenty of glitches, and I certainly would hear from some of those people. Trouble in the state? I mean, were there people that went a little while without income that you really had to work to get them back on track?
I think that's an accurate statement, Bob. We had, you know, it took us with these unemployment programs. They were tremendous programs and really helped us get some money out to individuals that were in some significant need. But it took us a while to get these programs up and running. We have a real state-of-the-art program that we just implemented, actually finished implementing in November. Thank goodness we had that in place before this hit, because it made, I think, the job of programming some of these new DOL programs a little bit easier, but it took time. And by the time we were getting some of this money out to individuals, they had been going 3-4 weeks without any type of income. So we were hearing from them, and my heart went out, you know, the agency's heart went out to them, because they were in dire straits and were literally in a panic mode. So yeah, it took a while, and when the money finally did start trickling out, a welcome relief, not only to us, but many, many, many people across the state.
Robin Cooley, again, visiting with us, the director of the Wyoming Department of Workforce Services. So it's been a nice summer. I know you were able to get some people employment. Unemployment numbers have repaired themselves a little bit. I'm curious, as you look ahead to the next few months, and I know Congress is debating some things as far as help, but is there a concern on the horizon?
I think there's a real concern on the horizon. As you know, we are implementing the Lost Wage Assistance Program now. Not implementing, we're programming it. We got approved for the funding, and we're getting it programmed out now and hope to have those funds going out to individuals quickly. But because those are FEMA funds and they're not UI, Department of Labor unemployment funds, there's a finite amount of funds available there. And so we're figuring that we're going to have payments maybe for 6, 7, potentially 8 weeks for individuals, and then that funding runs out. Certainly the hope is that by that time, Congress will have come together and we'll have a package ready to go and ready for individuals out there. But again, we're going to be looking at some time to program that new, the new policies and programs that they're going to come up with. So again, we're going to have this lapse of time where people are not going to have funds coming to them in a timely manner. So every time that happens, it's a difficulty for us, but certainly a difficulty for those individuals out there without incomes coming in.
I know there have been jobs that have popped up, and that's good news, but my understanding is when the fall and winter come, some of those disappear, and I wondered if that's going to couple some of the anxiety out there.
That's a possibility with that, the seasonal adjustments, but I have to tell you, I think that it's not doom and gloom. We're hearing about some real opportunities across the state for employment. In our 20 workforce centers across the state, they are reaching out, employers are reaching out to them, and they are doing a lot of work with virtual rapid response if there are layoffs in order to get people reemployed. We've had drive-up hiring events, in fact, where, in talking to some of these employers, they're getting, we had a drive-up event like that here a couple of weeks ago. They were looking for over 100 employees to hire. And in talking to that employer, they were getting more than enough applicants to choose from. So I think people are hiring. There are jobs out there. Now it's going to vary by community to community, but I don't think that it's all doom and gloom. There are hiring events happening across the state.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask, is it that many businesses are allowing people to do more virtually and that kind of thing?
I think that might be part of it. Just in the since April, I believe it is, the state has gained 7,700 jobs or 2.9% in employment. And those biggest job growth gains have been in leisure and hospitality, education and health services, trade, transportation, and utilities and construction. So there are gains happening across the state.
Do you see some maybe opportunities people aren't necessarily talking about yet coming in coming months that really could help out the state and get some people some well-paying jobs?
I also want to mention to you a grant that we just applied for. It's called the Reimagine Grant with the Department of Education. That grant is actually quite a bit of money attached to it, not a lot of numbers to that grant. But if we were to get it, the opportunities in that for entrepreneurs and innovators across the state are going to be tremendous. And we've had a lot of interest. We're working with educators, UW, the community colleges, K-12, and a lot of the incubators around the state. They helped us apply for that grant. We're waiting to hear on that, the outcome of that. But that's going to present a lot of opportunity as well if we are to be fortunate enough to get awarded those grant funds.
Well, hold on tight, Robin. Thank you so much for your time. Again, this is Robin Cooley. She is the director of the Wyoming Department of Workforce Services. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll talk to the company who could be owning a lot of Wyoming land. This is Open Spaces.
This season on the Modern West, the rural American West is struggling. Jobs disappearing, schools closing.
No matter where I went, there was always in my heart was I had a hometown, and it was still there waiting for me to come back.
It's the great ghost towning of America. But small towns are fighting back. A new season of the Modern West starts September 16th. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. As we've reported, Wyoming withdrew its bid for roughly 4 million acres of mineral rights and 1 million acres of land owned by the oil and gas company Occidental Petroleum. The winning bidder of the assets, Orion Mine Finance. John Lamb is a portfolio manager with the larger company Orion Resource Partners. Lamb joins Cooper McKim to provide some insight into their thinking behind the purchase, which is still underway.
So Orion is an investment firm. We specialize in the mining sector. We have a couple of different strategies that we focus on. One that is really at play here is investing in mineral royalty opportunities and building platforms around those. So for this investment, we've created a new company to hold our interest, Sweetwater Royalties, which will be focused on base metals and industrial minerals royalties, such as the Vetrona mineral leases in the land grant. Beyond that, part of our investment strategy is also focused on financing mining projects from the development stage into production. So we've been very active in financing the construction of new gold mines, copper mines, lithium mines globally.
So what does your involvement mean practically on the ground? Is it you guys who are hiring folks to help mine Trona, or is it contracting companies to do that mining? How does that actually work as far as you guys making money?
Our focus here is to partner with the existing operators that are on the ground for them to continue kind of the business as usual operations as they're currently being run, as well as working with other individuals who have an interest in doing further exploration work or other work on other pieces of the land grant where we have mineral rights. We're happy to partner with those groups and encourage further development. There's a significant amount of mineral acreage in this transaction, where there's certainly, I think, lots of potential beyond just the current areas that are producing Trona or oil and gas. And as well with some of the significant transmission projects and other renewables projects coming in, we also see an opportunity for development on some of the surface acreage that's part of this transaction as well. So looking to partner with people who are looking to work on those new projects.
What about recreation, grazing, hunting? I know that some of the concerns that Wyoming citizens have are about land access, and that the focus from a company might be more on the development side rather than the land access side. So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, we want the current users of the land to continue to enjoy the access that they have been with the land. We recognize that there's a lot of acreage here being used for grazing and other things. We want to continue to be supportive of our partners there who are using the land and try to find ways to continue to work together with those people.
Any considerations into investing in recreation or grazing or hunting or any of those sort of state specific things, or is the focus right now on investing with development opportunities?
I think we would certainly entertain a view on what other opportunities are there for the surface, whether it be on development or on recreational opportunities. I think we recognize the importance of both sectors.
Well, that's all my questions. Anything else you'd like to add?
Really excited to be at this point in the transaction, you know, looking forward to being a long-term partner in Wyoming, active in this area. It's an investment that we're very excited about to be purchasing these assets, and looking forward to hopefully a long, successful partnership with the operators and the communities here.
Well, thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you very much.
You know, if this was a normal year, many of you would be flocking to the middle of northern Nevada to watch the man burn. But it's not a normal year, and this year's Burning Man Counterculture Outdoor Festival has been canceled, along with many other live events across the region. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Paul Boger reports, that's taking its toll on the arts, the community, and the economy.
If you drive about 100 miles north of Reno, you'll eventually stumble onto a dry lake bed. Every Labor Day weekend, this barren stretch of alkali dust is the home of Black Rock City, the temporary metropolis that springs up from nothing for Burning Man. Most people at this point have heard of Burning Man, but to define exactly what it is, that's a little tricky. Some see it as an excuse for a drug-fueled week of debauchery in the desert. Others use it as a chance to get more in touch with their spirituality. For most people, though, it's something else.
The whole thing is a big piece of art.
That's Jerry Snyder, a Reno-based lawyer who's gone to every burn for the better part of two decades. He's even participated in the construction of several of those art projects. As a matter of fact, that's what he'd be doing right now if he had the choice. Instead, the event is like most live gigs these days, completely online. Snyder says the experience just won't be the same because there won't be the camaraderie of building an art installation together.
There's just nothing that builds a sense of community like that. Like, you know, doing something difficult in 100 degree heat and 40 mile an hour winds and whiteout dust conditions with a bunch of interesting, fun people.
Burners aren't the only ones missing out. Since moving from the Bay to the Black Rock Desert in the early 90s, Burning Man has played an ever-growing role in the area's arts and culture scene. In the last decade, art installations that were originally created for the festival have started springing up in Reno. Maria Partridge is with the Sierra Arts Foundation. She says without Burning Man, the recent dearth of all public art is noticeable.
I used to feel like Reno had so many things happening at any given time. You could go see music, you could go to a museum, you could go to a Broadway show, there's art opening, there's all these things happening. And now I feel like we've had nothing happening.
Of course, it's not all about the arts and community. It's also about money. Burning Man's ticket sales alone brought in more than $44 million for the organization last year. That's not counting any of the money the roughly 80,000 visitors pump into Northern Nevada's economy every year. Reno and neighboring towns are the last bastions of civilization before heading to the festival site, which means big business for everyone from car rental agencies and hotels to grocery and hardware stores. Eric Barron owns the Melting Pot Emporium, a shop popular with burners that sells an eclectic mix of clothing and goods. He says this is supposed to be his busy season.
I mean, we're not seeing any of the activity from festivals. I mean, I can tell you that Burning Man accounts for the Burning Man season accounts for about 20% of our annual sales. That's completely gone.
That's a scenario playing out across Nevada, the region, and the country as the festival and live gig industry have gotten slammed during this pandemic. A recent report from the Washington, D.C. think tank Brookings Institute named the creative economy as one of the sectors most at risk from the pandemic. It's something Dana Hale-Mounier knows all about.
You know, we're hopeful for survival.
Hale-Mounier owns Pacific Fine Arts Festivals, which puts on arts and crafts shows. She says the pandemic has forced her company to pivot and find new ways to reach buyers.
We need to just develop and get going, and hopefully we'll generate income in a way that's not dependent on in-person art events.
Still, Hale-Mounier is optimistic things will turn around. As a matter of fact, everyone I talked to was hopeful things would get back to normal eventually. But whether or not they can hold on in the meantime, that's a whole other question. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Paul Boger.
When we come back, we'll tell you about the saga of Yellowstone bison and how they're being acquired by Native American tribes. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the Modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last month, the first transfer of 40 Yellowstone National Park bison to 16 tribes across the nation occurred. Known as the Quarantine Program, it took a lot of negotiations between stakeholders for the program to move forward. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains why it's so hard to simply move bison outside of Yellowstone.
Bison used to roam the West in millions, but by the early 1900s, only a couple dozen were left inside Yellowstone. That's because the animal was overhunted by Western settlers. Yellowstone bison coordinator Chris Jeremiah says decades were spent to recover the population.
And as the population grew through the 20th century, they relearned migration routes that were lost.
During late winter, when the snow piles up, bison follow two large rivers to lower elevation areas in Montana, where several ranches are located, which is a problem. That's because 50% of the general bison population is infected with brucellosis. The Montana state vet, Martin Zulaski, says brucellosis causes cattle, elk, and bison to not be able to give birth, and the disease can be passed within the herd and between species.
When elk and cattle, or when bison and cattle share the same landscape during the kind of late pregnancy season, there's a potential for an infected animal, typically an elk, but potentially a bison, to abort and then contaminate that ground on which a cow may feed.
If cattle are infected with brucellosis, Jay Bodner with the Montana Stock Growers Association says it could be an economic disaster for the state. That's because people can get the disease by coming in contact with it, which means it can't be sold.
If those borders were to be shut off and nobody was to purchase those calves, people would have just went out of business because there would have been nowhere for that livestock to go. It would have been very restrictive. We would have got extremely low prices for the calves or the animals that were purchased.
That's why Montana sued Yellowstone National Park back in the 1990s to stop bison from migrating out of the park with the chance of transmitting brucellosis to their cattle. But it's worth noting that there have been documented cases of wild elk infecting cattle with the disease, while there has been no documented cases of wild bison infecting cattle. Still, an eventual compromise was reached with the creation of the Interagency Bison Management Plan, which includes state, federal, and tribal agencies. Yellowstone Bison Coordinator Chris Jeremiah says the goal is to maintain a wild, free-ranging bison population of around 3,000 in the park and to reduce the risk of any possible brucellosis transmission from bison to cattle.
And that was largely done by rounding up animals as they tried to exit the park and sending them to slaughter.
Jeremiah says for many years, bison stakeholders had been asking for the park to find an alternative to sending animals to slaughter. A major barrier to finding one is that due to trade restrictions, a brucellosis-infected animal cannot be transported across state and federal boundaries.
Because of this disease, we needed to find a way to first certify them as brucellosis-free, And that is the purpose of the quarantine program. And then if you can certify them as brucellosis-free, they can be transferred to new areas, to new homes.
The quarantine program was approved by all the parties involved, but as with anything, there were some hiccups. In March of 2018, some bison in the program were illegally released. They were eventually recaptured, but it led to restarting their quarantine. And then, in September of the same year, the former superintendent of Yellowstone was pushed out from his position, some say because of his support of the quarantine program. For Jeremiah, it's all about the different stakeholders working together towards the same ultimate goal, bison conservation.
It takes, you know, building and continuing this relationship with the Fort Peck tribes, who have really been the tribes to work with us, you know, from day one.
The Fort Peck tribes were vital in making the quarantine program happen by finding homes for these bison, mostly to other tribes. Like the 16 tribes that just received bison from the first successful quarantine.
That was Camila Kudelska on that story. We now go to Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr, who was there to see those very animals rounded up on the Fort Peck Reservation.
It's a bright August morning in northeast Montana. Robbie Magnin rose before dawn to coax these 40 buffalo into a corral. And if you think you're tired of staying home...
These guys have been in there for years, and most of their life they've been in some type of quarantine.
Magnin runs the Fort Peck Assiniboine and Sioux Tribe's Buffalo Quarantine Program. He says these bulls endured 2 years in quarantine at Yellowstone National Park and a third year here at Fort Peck, all to ensure they're free of the disease brucellosis.
But today is a good day because they'll go to a home where they'll never have to be tested again. And they have the rest of their life to enjoy being a buffalo.
Those new homes are with 16 other tribes, as far from here as Kansas, Wisconsin, and Alaska. A livestock trailer rolls up to the pasture to start a few of them on their journey.
Come on, I need all you buffalo handlers in your stations.
Convincing the buffalo to get on is not easy. Magnin says all this hard work is worth it to restore an animal that was once the center of life for tribes across the plains and the Mountain West.
They were, I call now, the one-stop Kmart or Walmart. They've given them everything they needed.
Food, clothing, shelter, buffalo were the center of tribal economies and spiritual life in this region. But in the late 19th century, many of those tribes found themselves at war with the U.S. government. And eliminating buffalo became a way to bring indigenous people to their knees.
They thought if they killed, you know, all of the buffalo, that they also would get rid of the Indians, you know.
That's Irvin Carlson, president of the Intertribal Buffalo Council, or ITBC.
But the buffalo are still here, and consequently, the tribes are still here.
The ITBC was created in 1991 to ensure that tribes had a seat at the table in managing Yellowstone buffalo.
And we always advocated for them animals to come out of Yellowstone alive. And we always advocated to do a quarantine facility.
But the cattle ranching community has advocated for the opposite. It took decades of negotiation for the ITBC and the Fort Peck tribes to get this quarantine facility off the ground and to finally get just 5 Yellowstone buffalo transferred into the facility in 2018. Carlson says that first group gave the tribal quarantine program a chance to prove itself. And with each passing year, more and more surplus Yellowstone buffalo have been sent to Fort Peck instead of the slaughterhouse.
There's always been a lot of hoops, you know, that we've had to jump through. And it's something that we have just worked diligently, I guess, for a lot of years to get this far for this happening today.
The tribes receiving these animals will use them to increase the health and genetic diversity of their own herds. That's a point of pride for Johnny Bear Cub Stiff Arm. She's one of a dozen or so Fort Peck tribal members gathered at the pasture today to see the buffalo off.
We have a drum group out here, and they'll sing the prayer songs to send the buffalo safely to their new homes, that they travel safe and receive blessings. And say goodbye to them for us. and we'll send them on their way.
Growing up, she never imagined that buffalo could live on tribal land.
We only read about buffalo in a book. We only saw a buffalo at a zoo or at some wildlife preserve that was non-Indian.
But for the Fort Peck community and the 16 other tribes that will receive these buffalo as gifts, that will no longer be the case.
You'll notice here at this gathering that there's some real little children here. Buffalo will always have been a part of their lives. And so for a lot of us older generation to be able to see that circle become complete has really been meaningful.
The Fort Peck tribes and the ITBC are expecting to take in a new shipment of Yellowstone buffalo sometime in the spring. It will be only a fraction of the park's surplus population. Hundreds more will go to slaughter. Still, today's historic transfer sends a message that politics and red tape won't continue to stand in the way of tribal buffalo restoration. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
From bison to the stars, a team of University of Wyoming astronomy students have compiled the largest ever catalog of quasars. Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone spoke with graduate student Brad Like about what a quasar is and why they are important.
The short version is that they are the biggest, angriest engines in the universe. The slightly longer version is that every galaxy has a supermassive black hole at the center that we're aware of, but they aren't all drawing in material at the same time. And it's the actual process of drawing in the material which causes the whole thing to release a lot of light, and that thing itself is the quasar. It's the black hole plus the material being sucked in, so it's a process more than an object.
So not every black hole is a quasar.
No, but every quasar has a supermassive black hole at the center.
How do we look at quasars?
We want spectra instead of just a picture that, you know, you can see with your eyes. So for a spectrum, we spread the light out kind of like you do with a prism and then look at all the different colors and how much of each color there is.
And what does that tell you?
It tells us chemistry, processes, age sometimes, and even distance from just the spectra.
And how do you tell a quasar spectrum from any other kind of spectrum?
That's a big part of what this research is. The easiest way, of course, is for somebody to look at it. And there will be a certain type of feature called a broad emission line in a squiggly spectrum. You'll see some spike, a big and tall spike that just shows up. That's a broad emission line, as long as it's pointing up. And quasars are pretty much the only object that have those. It can take a while to look at a little spectra, especially if it's really far away object. It can take human beings a little while. So you need to train a computer to do it in those numbers.
So how many quasars are in your catalog?
We have 1.5 million things they thought was a quasar originally, and we have to go back through and say yes or no. And then we end up with half, 750,000.
And so why is identifying all of these quasars important?
The primary project is studying dark energy, the expansion of space and time. And you need quasars, because they're very, very bright, the angriest engines in space. So you can see them far away. So we can look at a whole swath of space and a whole swath of history, a whole swath of time, to see how dark energy affected things over time.
How does looking further away let you look at longer periods of time?
So that comes down to the speed of light. It travels at a certain speed, and if something's far enough away, it takes light time to get to us. So by the time a distant object gets to us, what we saw was the light from could be millions or even billions of years ago. So what you're seeing is the past. I described it one place as the childhood photo album. of the universe. That's what telescopes give us. The expansion part only looks at where a quasar is in space, because that's all we need to know is where is it. But there's a lot of people who want to know what they are, because we don't really understand them very well. So being able to provide them with a very large catalog of quasars of all strengths, all over space, all ages, lets them study the physics of quasars so we can finally understand what's happening.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone speaking with UW astronomy graduate student Brad Like. Like's quasar database was published in August and was the result of a worldwide collaboration of scientists. Coming up, we will chat about 2020's top Western art museum. And when there's no football, there's also no marching band. Those stories are up next on Open Spaces.
You know, while you're on a road trip, it'd be weird to be in the car with 81 ducks or 81 lit candles. That's a fire hazard. But 81 Human Nature podcast episodes, that would make your road trip amazing.
We could have probably, you know, power walked faster.
I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm going to hit this bear.
I'm Erin Jones. Binge all 81 Human Nature episodes under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The Brinton Museum sits on the historic Circle A Ranch at the base of the Bighorn Mountains. Named after Bradford Brinton, the museum prides itself on its extensive collection of Western and American Indian art. Recently, the magazine True West announced it as the top Western art museum of 2020. Ken Schuster, the Brinton's director and chief curator, spoke with Catherine Wheeler about what the honor means for the museum.
True West is, you know, a very popular pulp magazine, and it's a great honor to win, you know, the theoretically best Western art museum in the country. I mean, I don't know how you really pick that, and, you know, I'm certain that, of course, we believe we deserve it. And one of the things that that award does is they have a very active readership, and that readership goes to museums. So it's really an important honor and a great distinction, and it's a feather in our cap that we'll wear proudly, even though I sort of feel like Marlon Brando. I cannot accept this because I think there are 25 other institutions that are just as good.
What do you think really contributed to such a distinction from, you know, all of the art museums that could possibly be selected?
Well, the distinction, in my point of view, is what I always feel has set the Brinton apart for the 30 years that I've been director here, and that's that it's this marvelous institution located on a beautiful piece of property in really God's country. I mean, it's a gorgeous place. When you come to the museum, you can't help but be inspired by the views. We have a great collection of traditional American art, Russell, Remington, all of those characters. We have a very, very wonderful collection of American Indian art. We have 628 acres, which most other museums don't have. We've put a hiking trail out there, and we've kept those trails very undeveloped because we don't want to really disturb the property because, you know, as we all know, this was American Indian land, and it's sacred to them. And that's part of the real thing that I think distinguishes us from many institutions is, you know, we pride ourselves in a great relationship with the Lakota and the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow or Assaluke people because they're the folks whose artwork comprises most of our, you know, indigenous population. And we hope to build better relations and even stronger relations with the Shoshone and the Arapaho and the Blackfeet and really all Native people. And we're open to building a more contemporary vision of the West and collecting more contemporary Western art.
When you hear the classification like Western Art Museum or Western art, what is that encapsulating? Like, what is Western art?
To me, Western art isn't the pejorative term that it's gotten to be in academia. To me, Western art is any depiction of the American West, west of the Mississippi, done by indigenous people or the colonialists, you know, Americans, French, Spaniards, any of that. I think that's all relevant Western art. And I don't make the distinction that it has to have a cowboy in it. I think that's where you start, you know, separating out people and saying, well, you know, you can't have this, you can't have that. You know, Western art is a genre that's it's open to all people and all things.
Do you think that the idea of Western art is maybe encapsulating certain ideas or qualities that this place in the world has and that it's different from others?
Oh, I think the thing that everybody would agree upon, you know, whether you're very, very traditional with your interpretation of Western art or you're an academic, is that the West, it's the landscape, it's the land that is really causing that relationship and promoting those depictions. And that's true whether you're an indigenous person or whether you've just, you know, stepped off a plane from Cairo. You can't help but be inspired and overcome, or maybe even put off by that open space or this sense of emptiness.
This acknowledgement is done annually. I was wondering if there's anything in the past year that you have been really proud of, like a special exhibition that has come or something you've put together?
Well, we're always proud of what we do here at the Brinton. But one of the things that we worked on, and this isn't the first time we've done it, but we partner with the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies, or CARINS, and that Dockaway exhibit in the other room, I'm very proud of that. Even though people walk in and are put off by the whole idea of the Wounded Knee Massacre, it's not about the massacre. Yes, a massacre occurred, and it's about how this people, you know, how they deal with that. And I think the message that CARINS is trying to get across there is there are as many ways to deal with that Wounded Knee Massacre as there are Lakotas or people that even go to the site and see it. And I don't think that you can go into that exhibit and come away unmoved.
And is there anything specific you're looking forward to in the year ahead?
Well, we're excited about a lot of things that are coming down the road. And one of the things, we're going to be having our American Indian Advisory Council at the end of this week. And one of the things that we're looking for help with is we have this great idea of collecting stories from the different tribes represented on our council. And we'd like to gather those stories and then have our American Indian Advisory Council give us names of, you know, indigenous artists from their tribes that could illustrate them. And I think, and that exhibit will be here in 2022. That'll be our illustrator show. And we're really excited about that. We think that'll be a great opportunity for children. It'd be a great opportunity for the people that participate. And I think it'll build a stronger relationship between the indigenous community and this museum, which I think is really, really important.
That was the Brinton Museum's Ken Schuster speaking with Catherine Wheeler. You know, for many, this time of year means the start of college football, but not this year. Without game days and everything that goes along with tailgating, some college towns across our region, including here in Laramie, will look different, and they're going to sound different, too, as Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explains.
For Casey Stevenson, this is what this time of year usually sounds like.
Ladies and gentlemen, for your halftime enjoyment, the 2018 edition of your Western Thunder Marching Band.
Stevenson is a member of the marching band here at the University of Wyoming. They're known as the Western Thunder.
We spend probably at least 8 or so hours a day on game days playing for fans. So without the bands on game days, like, it would be awfully quiet.
Like today, Stevenson and I are sitting outside War Memorial Stadium, and the only sound filling the air is the wind blowing against the flagpole and the motor of a few university lawnmowers. Since Stevenson is a senior this year, this will be our last season. So it was difficult when the Mountain West Conference fall sports season was canceled.
I broke down. Like, it was just, it was absolutely devastating.
Plus, Stevenson has a pretty important job in the band.
This past season was my first season as head drum major, and it was a dream come true.
It's up to her to lead the entire band, directing them what to play and when to play it. And there's a lot of moving parts, literally. Plus, a lot of work that needs to get done before anyone steps out on the field.
So you have your wind line, which includes all of, like, the wind instruments. They have to learn music, memorize music, learn their drill, memorize where they're going, and, like, putting all of that together. And then you have the drum line, who they spend hours upon hours perfecting every little stroke and everything.
And of course, they have to memorize their music and moves as well. And let's not forget the auxiliary line, visual performers, dancers, baton twirlers, and all things pom-pom.
So it's a lot of working parts to put on just like that 8-minute halftime show.
And it's not just the Mountain West Conference that's affected. The Big Sky Conference called off its fall sports season too. Cannon Shane is a student at the University of Montana and a member of the Grizzly Marching Band.
I kind of had a feeling that it was going to happen or they would push it to the spring. Just was uncertain as to how the season would look since our main performance venue was the football games.
Shane says so much of marching band is about really energizing the crowd and the team. On game days, everything revolves around that.
Usually if like the kickoff is at 1 p.m., the band meets at 9 a.m., we have a rehearsal, we work on last minute edits of our show, we do something called Grizz Walk here.
That's where the band lines up along the sidewalk outside the athletics building. They form a kind of musical tunnel for the players to walk through on their way to the stadium to warm up. Cannon says it usually draws a pretty good crowd of fans, too, that dance around and cheer for the players and the band. But Shane's favorite song to play is actually one you might recognize from the radio.
Shut Up and Dance. It's a really unique arrangement. It's fun to play, especially the piccolo part.
That one is popular with a lot of college bands, actually. Here's one rendition. Shane says they're trying to come up with other ways to play for fans. Somewhere that's still outdoors, but in smaller groups. Western Thunder in Wyoming is trying to do that too. But in the meantime, Casey Stevenson says she's been reflecting back on some of her favorite marching band memories.
Getting to conduct Cowboy Joe at the end of the game after we won, there's a picture of me actually. I'm conducting and I'm just grinning from ear to ear and like just one of the best feelings ever.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and individual segments are available on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can listen to the program on evening dog walks by signing up for our podcast through that website or all the usual places. Anna Rader is our web editor. Support this high-quality news program with your donation through our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.